This program is a production of the Reformed Forum, an organization devoted to producing and distributing Reformed theological content for a connected age. Online at reformedforum.org. This is the Reformed Media Review, episode number 37. On the program today, jazz pianist Pamela York. Welcome to the Reformed Media Review, your regular look at books and culture from a Reformed perspective. My name is Camden Busey. I'm very pleased to be broadcasting today out of Westminster Theological Seminary. We've got a nice room here where we've set up all our equipment, and we're doing a little experiment in video. And to join me in this experiment, we have the Director of Admissions from Westminster, Jared Oliphant. Thanks for coming over, Jared. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Good to be here.
We also have Jonathan Brack, who is admissions counselor as well as a student here at Westminster. Thanks for joining us again, Jonathan.
Thanks, Camden.
And we're very pleased to welcome Nathan Shannon, who is a student, a PhD student, in fact, at the Free University of Amsterdam. Welcome back, Nathan.
Thank you for having me, Camden.
Today we've got another great episode lined up. Last week we discussed painting. We discussed with Mike Mahon a Christian approach to the fine arts. And today we're going to continue along that trajectory by speaking with a very special guest, Pamela York, who is a jazz pianist near Houston, Texas. Thank you so much for joining us, Pamela. It's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you.
Well, I'm very excited because I love jazz and blues and all these sorts of musical traditions, and to speak about them from a Christian perspective is going to be quite interesting, and I'm going to pass things over to Jonathan as he's going to start our discussion today.
Thanks, Camden. Yeah, I'm really excited about this episode. Similar to last episode, we've been talking a lot about different ways in which Christianity influences the arts.
Right.
And once again, there's not a lot out there written about a Christian and especially a Reformed perspective of the arts. And so last week we got into the painterly with Mike Mahon, and this week it's something I think is really exciting. We'll talk to Pamela York, who is an OPC pastor's wife. So probably as Reformed as you can get as a wife, but also a renowned jazz musician. I've listened to her work. I've seen her play, I think, about three times, and I'm always impressed. I have both of her CDs. It's really great work, and so I'm really excited to have her on. But what I really wanted to do is to interview Pamela and ask her a couple of questions about Christianity and jazz. And so, because that's sometimes jazz, classically is kind of looked at as not very Christian.
Right, its history isn't always the brightest in Christian circles.
Right, sometimes it can be considered
immoral
sort of
music and the underground type of thing, and you think of the era of Prohibition and all that, and the jazz is associated.
That's exactly right. And so it's
flappers.
So considered sinful music in the past. So so just to start things out, Pamela, what would you say as far as a proper biblical model for a genre of music that's like jazz, as far as a Christian approach to that?
Yeah, well, the music I perform, I do sing, but most of it is instrumental. So I'm not using, words like, say, Amy Grant would, or an artist that you would think of in as being a Christian musician.
Right.
Okay. So since I'm working primarily as an instrumentalist, I think my standard is to glorify God and to play with excellence. And I think, depending on your instrument and what style you're playing, it's going to be a little bit different. If you're playing a Brahms concerto or if you're playing a blues in B flat, there's a certain amount of study that goes into each one that's unique. And a musician really has to do their homework. But I think playing with skill and excellence and the dedication it takes, I think that kind of skill is what I would want to develop as a Christian, and bring to the music my best, my very best.
Now, some people will think jazz is just a free genre where anything goes, and there are certain quarters of the jazz genre where that is true, but there is an awful lot of work and preparation that needs to go into being able to improvise with others and to play with others, and there's a huge amount of knowledge you need to know about chord theory and things like that. So there are numerous technical dimensions that you do have to master in order to play excellently, aren't there?
Exactly. And the mechanics of the piano are the same, whether you're going to be a jazz musician or a classical musician. If you think of Chick Corea or Keith Jarrett or Herbie Hancock, they could all play a Mozart piano concerto or a Bach prelude.
I saw a clip. I watched a documentary on Keith Jarrett, and they showed that clip where Keith Jarrett is one of the world's most famous jazz piano players, for the listener who might not know. In fact, he can improvise an entire hour-long set, and it will sound like nothing he's ever played before. But then they show other clips where he is playing a duet of a classical piece, a highly technical classical piece with Chick Corea. And it's just phenomenal, the skill he has and to be able to play both types of music.
Yeah, I think he recorded the Bach Preludes and Fugues, right? I think I have a copy.
I believe he did, yes. Yeah. And just the skill that goes into just learning the basics of an instrument carries over into either a jazz or classical. It's the same, C minor harmonic or C minor melodic scale that you're going to learn in, it's the same harmony. But yes, in jazz, there's, unless you're playing free jazz, which is, like you said, a whole other bag, you're
different
really...
Different cats play that kind of jazz.
And
jazz spelled with
three Z's.
Yeah. And also, in classical music, classical music, there are pieces that have improvised sections too, where the player is given maybe a couple of different intervals or rhythmic ideas, and you can improvise on that. So, but the bulk of what we call jazz music does have a form. It does have structure. It may be a 32 measure form AABA structure that most of the songs like I Got Rhythm and a lot of the songs from the 1930s and 40s that George Gershwin and Cole Porter wrote are that structure. It could be a 12-bar blues. It could be through composed, which means that it doesn't have sections that necessarily repeat, but the material flows into the next section. But yeah, you have to study form, definitely. And being able to improvise on the form, you really have to have the form down, because if you can't play the piece, how are you going to improvise on those chord changes when it comes time for you to solo? So yeah, there is a tremendous amount of work and time that goes into it. You just don't decide you're going to play jazz one day, and in a few weeks be able to do it. It's like studying a foreign language. You've got to study the grammar, and you've got to speak with people who speak that language to really get all those nuances and phrases and everything that goes into speaking well.
Right.
Down. So
there's some analogies there, just with the Christian life and also with theology too. To do it well, you can't just walk in and decide that you're going to read your Bible and be an expert interpreter one day. It takes a lot of work to read and to study the greats and to read what they have to say. And it's a lifestyle. And to be very good and to be excellent and to glorify God to the best of your ability with playing jazz or playing any style of music or doing anything in the arts, likewise, takes a lot of effort. You can't just pick it up one day and expect to be the greatest in the world.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely not instant gratification. I mean, it is when you learn a new chord and you listen to it and go, oh, that sounds really good. Mm-hmm. But yeah, to put it all together and to make a statement that really says something and really communicates to an audience, that's the kind of thing that takes experience and many years of practice.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, you were classically trained. Is that correct?
Yes, I was. I started taking lessons when I was 8 years old, mm-hmm. and just studying all the basics that every piano student does, and scales, and all the different eras, you know, Baroque, classical, romantic music, 20th century. And
What was then, it that that led you to jazz from that classical training?
Well, I grew up in Canada, and I don't know if you've heard of Oscar Peterson, but
oh, yeah.
One of the great jazz pianists ever, you know, in history, is Canadian. So I would see him on the CBC radio and television. Television, yeah, mainly. And I just thought that was wonderful. I also had a friend who moved into our neighborhood, and their parents played country music, country rock, but still the blues is a part of that music too. So I used to play at some of their afternoon jam sessions, and had to really begin improvising then. But it was mainly in high school that I got started. We had a jazz band at our high school, and I could read the notes, but when it came time to solo and all those chord changes were in front of me and it said piano solo, you know, I really had to figure it out. What am I going to do here? I need some vocabulary.
Right.
And I don't know if you all have heard of Diana Krall.
Oh, one of my favorites.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, she is from my hometown as well, of Nanaimo, British Columbia.
Diana Krall's Canadian, too?
Yeah.
We're going to edit that out.
So when I was 15 years old, she came in one day to my high school. And, of course, she was just getting started in Los Angeles and hadn't recorded yet. But anyway, she came and visited my band director, Brian Stovall. And I had some questions, and she showed me some progressions. And every time she was in town visiting her parents, I would get a lesson. So she really got me started. This is who you need to listen to. Mm-hmm. You know, this is what you need to know. And really practical information too. Like, if you're going to be playing in this hotel lobby and someone walks up and wants to hear Take Five, do you know that song? You know?
Oh, Dave Brubeck.
Wow. And, yeah. Yeah. Just really, really practical advice, along with, what I really needed to hear at that stage, which was, you know, really listening. And it sounds simple, but you know, I think it was easier back then when I was a teenager getting started. But when you think of everything that you're bombarded with, and you hear music in the elevator, but are you really listening? You know,
right?
Just to really listen and to study those important jazz recordings, so that it becomes you get a concept of what you need to sound like, what the swing mm-hmm. needs, rhythms need to sound like.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Well, now, did you end up sharing the gospel with Diana? I'm just kidding.
You know what? I did not grow up in a Christian household. So at that point, I was not even attending church. So that's my answer.
Well, speaking about listening with others and speaking a common language and all that, one thing that maybe isn't apparent to some people, and we've already talked a little bit about this, is in order to improvise well, you have to know the structure. You have to know what you're going to improvise off of. But that whole experience of improvising and spontaneously creating is very attractive to many artists. In fact, some fans of jazz and blues actually kind of like to romanticize the improvisational mm-hmm. dimension. They kind of call it a spiritual experience. Now, what would you say regarding a Christian's understanding of musical inspiration and improvisation? How would we understand music as a spiritual experience?
Yeah, that's a difficult question, because it's interesting. A lot of people will listen to a recording like John Coltrane's A Love Supreme.
Sure.
And say, wow, that was really spiritual.
Yeah.
But I think Are you talking about in the sense of being inspired to play well and to, or are you?
Well, anyway you want to take that or understand that, just the whole dynamics of inspiration and improvisation and the Holy Spirit enabling you to do well, anything.
Yeah, I think that, you know, that God gives you, your desires, mm-hmm. and that they're, you know, obviously to be used, to glorify Him. And I can't say that it's something that I would think about or you know, analyze while I'm performing, but I would certainly say that, you know, I have been inspired and have really, you know, gotten a certain idea or a certain melody that comes to me. And I would say that, you know, that I'm being inspired and using everything that's a part of my vocabulary, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. that I've studied, you know, when you think about it, the instrument is just wood and strings and, you know, different parts. Mm-hmm. So it's really your body and your mind that the music, you know, it's inside of you. So I can't say that I've thought about this very much, but it's definitely, difficult to put into words. I think that I have been, like I said, been given gifts that I need to use. Mm-hmm. And, as far as improv goes, can I back up a bit too?
Sure.
And say that it actually used to be a part of the classical tradition to improvise. Mozart and Beethoven, when they wrote a piano concerto, they did improvise the cadenzas. Hmm. And then they actually wrote some down, and that's what most people play when they perform. But it's kind of a lost art in the classical world to improvise you know, a cadenza or a solo, but it was actually very much a part of some of the great composers. They could do that. So it is, I guess, more prominent in the jazz tradition, but has been a part of the classical tradition as well.
Yeah, you're right. When I think of something like Rachmaninoff, I always think, no way this guy played the same song the exact same way twice. I mean, there's so many notes here, and these chords are huge, and you know, the rhythms are strange at some points. And I always think when he was writing this, whatever was written down, I wonder what some of the other ways he could have played this song when he was working it out. But
yeah, I was thinking about that. It seemed to me when you were talking about learning to improvise, I know a lot of classical musicians who would say, that they would never be able to improvise, and they're sort of scared to death of it. You know, have a improvisational phobia.
yeah.
Know? And even when they perform without a score, they're still really anchored in the score. But at the same time, like Jonathan says, it's really some kind of cosmic impossibility to perform the same piece twice exactly the same way, even if you're the same guy, maybe same hall, same instrument. It's sort of a like an ontological impossibility. Every time it's a new experience, yeah. Right? You know,
I love that song.
You're absolutely right.
I think we just got a name for our band.
You're like yeah. a Heraclitus musician over here.
Yeah. We're not computers. We're not programmed to play the exact same tempo or to play that chord at exactly the same time. I mean, when you have an ending, say that may be ritardando, which means gradually slowing down. One night you may slow it down sooner than another night. Sure, you know, right. It's there's so many different things, like you said, that in the concert hall, the action on the piano, the distractions in the hall. But it was interesting because just 2 weeks ago, I gave a master class to the classical piano students at the American Festival for the Arts here in Houston.
Wow.
They do have a jazz program. Unfortunately, it was canceled this year due to not having quite enough students to make our minimum. But anyway, went in and did the master class, and I had four of them improvising on a blues in F before I left.
Wow, no kidding.
That's cool.
And, you converted them.
You need to be
yeah,
they may never back, no.
Take it easy on the guitar players. Put that in.
Yeah, and it's what was so funny is they didn't really think they sounded that well because they have really high standards and all of them did fine. But
yeah, a different set of standards, you know, rhythmic perfection and all these kind of things. Where,
yeah.
You know, I think it's a sort of a mismatch of categories, right?
Yeah, and they're just so used to analyzing every single bit of the score and perfecting it. So for them to feel the feeling of improvising, which is really spontaneous composition, it was quite freeing for them, but also a little bit, you know, they were kind of judging themselves a little bit too harshly, you know,
something
they've practiced for months and months and then something that they just made up. I think they had the feeling that it wasn't all that good, even though I thought they sounded really good. So,
so maybe I was thinking maybe as far as, you know, improvisation versus, you know, performing from the score or from a, you know, just performing the piece that's already been composed. Maybe the aspect of improvisation is just a matter of degree because, as you said, you can play with the tempo indications or the interpretive indications a little bit. And then from there, you know, it's just a matter of increasing the improvisational factor by steps until you're doing, you know, 12 bars of solo or something like that. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think I try to teach students to take an idea or a little motive or a little short melodic idea. It might be two or three notes and then just start to move it around and then maybe change the direction of the interval. If you go up a third, go down a third and just little ideas like that. Yeah. But I also will have them imitate me because I think imitation is one of the best ways to learn jazz. You listen to the recording, you hear what Herbie Hancock plays on Dolphin Dance, and then you go, oh, okay, now I understand what he's doing. It's putting yourself in the shoes of the masters and really walking how they walked, building up your vocabulary, and then later having something to say yourself.
Right.
Your own voice comes through eventually because you've done your homework. So
it's interesting. Clearly, it's the same idea in guitar, even with blues guitar, or even with rock guitar, where, you know, as a young boy, when I was starting to play, you just listen over and over and you try to repeat the people that you enjoy listening to down to the little detail, whether you're slowing the track down as far as you can in order to be able to learn the tricks.
Yep.
But then you start to learn all these licks and these riffs, and then you start to put them together. And if you really examine even a guitarist like Eric Clapton, and he'll even admit to this, when he has his bag of tricks, and he often goes back to the same bag of tricks. If someone hasn't heard a lot of him, is not going to hear those things. But we all have a vocabulary, as you say, and we start to piece it together and change things and move things around, and that's part of the whole process of improvisation. And then you add your own character to it, your own variations.
And, absolutely,
that's the whole process.
Yeah, and we're improvising right now, aren't we? I mean, we have never had this conversation.
Big time.
That's the whole
that's
show.
That's what we do.
We've never had this conversation before. You know, we know.
Or have we?
Yeah. we know.
Inception comes out Friday.
Yeah, approximately what kind of things we want to. Some ideas we want to have come across, but it's going to come out a little differently tonight than it would maybe a different night.
Yeah.
And
that's a great point.
I sometimes like to teach students too that you can't expect to just learn a phrase and be able to just, you know, play it at a particular tempo on a particular song, because, you know, when you think about, I'm a parent and I have a 16-month-old right now, and he pretty much says mama for everything. Well, later on, he's going to be able to say, you know, we'll able to point to red and say red, and we'll be able to point to his car and say car. And he's learning these short words that eventually are going to become phrases. And then eventually it's kind of like, are you familiar with the classical model of education? Mm-hmm. You know, the trivium. Grammar stage, mm-hmm. the trivium, the dialectic, and then the rhetoric. So it's kind of like that.
I had kind of a different question related to this topic, though. I was wondering if you had any thoughts on jam bands, or if you're you know, familiar with that. It's kind of related, but
a lot of improvisation.
Yeah, a lot of improvisation, but you know, the common complaint is it just lasts so long. I don't know if this falls into the category, but I was able to see Dave Matthews Band and Bela Fleck, and they are just masters at turning like a 3-minute song into like a 10 or 12 minute song. And it sounded great, but there are others who are not as successful as that. But I didn't know if those two topics were related or if you had any thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think, I think they're coming from the same kind of tradition as far as, you know, improv goes.
Yeah.
I haven't really checked out a lot of, that kind of music. I'm familiar with Bela Fleck, but I know that, you know, it's just kind of expanding the form and making just longer periods to improvise on. And sometimes, I'm sure you've heard this too, sometimes the groove will change, or the time will change, or maybe the key will change. And, it's just another form of, I think some of the sections may be a lot more wide open for improv than some of the jazz standards are.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that's good too. But you're right. I mean, in the hands of the more skilled players like Bela Fleck, it could be a lot more successful than someone who's kind of just noodling and doesn't really have an arc to their solo that's taking you somewhere.
Yeah, well put.
Yeah, Pamela, I had a sort of thought that I'd wanted you to comment on. We were talking about improvisation, and as far as relating to theology, you said earlier that it's good to learn and start with the forms, because you have to be able to do improvisation off of something. And so I think that there's somewhat of an analogy there to theology, where there is a progression in theology. Theology is not just a constant re-articulation of the same beliefs over and over and over again. There is definitely a progression, but nevertheless, there is a structure that you have to, that, you know, there's non-negotiables.
Why we catechize.
Right. There's parts of the fence that you can't cross. But nevertheless, inside that, the sort of like a safe domain, there is a lot of nuancing and colorful progression that can happen. Mm-hmm. Any comments on that?
Well, it just brought to mind the Lord's Prayer, how we're always taught to say that kind of as a guide when you're a new Christian, you know, to learn the Lord's Prayer, and then to think about each line and kind of expand on it when you're making your request known, when you're confessing sin. But also when you think about it too, the scriptures are wonderful because they're not just a catechism, a tool.
Right.
They are poetry.
Moral guidebook or anything.
Yeah.
Like that.
They're all they're letters, they're poetry, they're, you know, and structure, of course, especially the Psalms, and, you know, there's that kind of thing that we study, and then we can really kind of learn how to pray.
Right.
That's a great point. Yeah. The prayers are always, of course, informed by our theology and our understanding. Those prayers, in a sense, when they're not done, when you're not reading a prayer, you are improvising it.
Yeah.
You're doing as you know and as you feel led. And it's analogous to music.
Yeah. There's
Jonathan,
150 Psalms.
Right, scripture.
You're going to run out at some
right.
point.
Yeah. And what Pamela was saying earlier is that, you know, you're given a vocabulary, and that is similar to scripture. Of course, you're given a vocabulary,
right.
And you have something to say after you learn that vocabulary well.
Well, on that point, quite a few years ago, when I first came to seminary, I was talking to Dr. Tipton and asking him about his philosophy of theological education, and particularly the Master of Divinity degree. And he said, I basically don't want anyone to have any creative thoughts during the MDiv. And his point was, there's a time to learn and to soak it up, kind of like with the classical model. And then there's a time to put those things together and synthesize. And he sees his own view People would differ with this, but his own view is that that's what the THM and PhDs are for having a
creative
thought.
Yeah, and I agree, and I think that a lot of times, you know, young seminary student will learn some, you know, have a month of Greek classes and have a couple of other courses and think that they've really got it together, you know.
The next
and
maybe Calvin.
Speak, a genius.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and speak a little too soon. I guess in every field, you know,
Jonathan.
There's that tendency to really get to really get the confidence, and that's good. But just to continue to you know, maybe close your lips and open up your ears just a little more until you're able to get through that grammar stage and into expressing your thoughts and being informed by, you know, who God is and how he what the purpose of the Bible is, you know, him making a kingdom for himself. If you don't have that, that's your structure to.
Right.
Those
questions come in the classroom, the lecture questions, the questions that turn into lectures and
sermons.
They come too soon in the education.
Yeah, yeah. It's sermon. So
Professor,
what did you think?
Excuse me.
That's my question.
Well, I think you're wrong.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, it's funny because I think Adam went to General Assembly for the OPC.
Right.
Well, yeah, for the first time, and I think he went last year, and he said that he wasn't going to say anything the first time he went.
Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if he did or not, but just, you know, it's just the wisdom that comes with, kind of knowing, where you are in your knowledge and your learning and, how we have so much to learn and we're lifelong students of the Bible, and music and learning.
Good point.
Now, speaking of theology, how was it that somebody who is a jazz musician, like yourself, and you know, you could somewhat say studied even under the tutelage of Diana Krall, but came into Reformed theology and end up actually marrying a Reformed OPC pastor.
Yeah, if you would have told me in college that I would be the wife of a pastor, I would, you know, I don't know what I would think. it wasn't in my thoughts at all. But I was a Christian before I came to the University of Tennessee in 1993. I was going to move there to work on my master's degree. And my husband, Adam, was working on his philosophy degree. And we had an RUF on campus, Reformed
nice.
University Fellowship, you know, the ministry of the PCA. And so I was invited to go to one of their Tuesday night groups. And because I didn't grow up in the church, I really didn't have a lot of ideas and traditions, you know. So I know a lot of people come to Reformed theology after maybe growing up Catholic or Baptist or atheist and just having a lot of issues to work through, but I really didn't. It all kind of made sense to me because I really didn't have a background and or any baggage with me, really.
Yeah.
But anyway, we met and we got married a couple years later, and I knew he was going to go to Westminster Seminary when we got married, and we went out there, and he really was going to be a teacher, and maybe teach at the college level. And after that first year, he said, you know, I'm really feeling like being a pastor is my call. And it happened so gradually that I really wasn't shocked. But there really is no blueprint for what I'm doing as far as being a musician, being the wife of a pastor, and homeschooling, too.
Mm-hmm.
One musician friend did say, you know, you're going to have to make up your own blueprint because how you go about doing things and the different seasons of life is just going to be a lot different, how you're going to fit things in with all of those roles.
Yeah.
So it has been interesting, but at the same time, I think God brought each thing into my life gradually. You know, I grew up and I learned the piano and I went to college and got my master's degree. Mm-hmm. And then I got married. And then 7 years later, I had my first child. So it wasn't like everything came at once and, okay, now what am I going to do with my time? You know, I had a certain number of years behind me, fortunately, before I became a mother, and just time-wise, it that was a good thing because I couldn't have handled everything that I do now, you know, all at once, mm-hmm. if it happened all at once. But yeah, it's definitely not the norm.
yeah, you say that.
Same old story.
I guess I don't think about it too much because I'm just too busy for one. But yeah, because like I said, things came gradually over time. I've been able to take on each role as it came.
Pamela, so. I'm kind of hoping we get a chance to speak about sort of in an objective sense about music, and religion or music and ethics, actually. But I wanted to maybe ask you a personal question, if you don't mind, about the relationship between music and between your own faith, or even your own, to use some popular terminology, your own sort of walk. So I can say for myself, music, I realized even over the last month or two, because of circumstances in my life, I had to lock up all my CDs in storage. And I realized after a few weeks that I was sort of suffering as a result. So I ran to YouTube like a starving man, you know, and I started watching.
You became very ill.
I felt ill in my soul, to be honest. And I just started watching. Now almost every night I have to go on and watch somebody play something beautiful. And
watch Double Rainbows in order to.
And
great clip.
I don't know that. I don't know what that is. But anyway, I just realized myself that listening, as you said, you were talking about active listening or really listening. You said I realized that that's a real part of my spiritual life. Some kind of egghead reform people might get worried about a comment like that, but maybe you can echo those feelings.
Yeah, I think, we have a God who is a wonderful creator. And I mean, if we think of all the things that we can see and hear and taste, it's marvelous. And I think there's the urge that we have as human beings to create. For me, it's music. And as a listener too, you're right. I think there's a need that we have that, since we're made in God's image, that we need to hear, and we need to hear beautiful things, fulfilling things. I can tell you that music is so important to me that, I actually am a better person, more patient mother, et cetera, after I've practiced. And I know might sound kind of funny, like it's an idol, but
not at all.
But it just fulfills something that words kind of cannot describe in me. I'm feel confident that that's my contribution to the world, harness that creativity and use it for God's glory, and it brings such a sense of fulfillment and does bring me peace and comfort and joy too.
Yeah. So I love what you said, because you said that after you practice, you feel like you've done your part, or that's your peace or your contribution to the kingdom or to God's glory. And I think you've hit for me on a deep and very important principle for the arts specifically, because when you practiced piano, at least I think you were probably alone, and so you practiced piano by yourself and worked on problems or technical things, yes, or passages or chord progressions that interested you specifically, and you know, things you were interested in at the time. And even if you translate that to the stage when you perform, I think no one, you know, not even the other musicians on stage will have as deep an appreciation for the musical experience that you had that mm-hmm. evening. And so there is some kind of exclusivity to it, which I think is very glorious and happy, because it's your private approach to the throne.
Right. Yeah.
Mm.
But I think it's, you know, it ends up, I'm sorry, I'm doing all the talking. We're supposed to be interviewing you, but I think sometimes this turns people off, because it can, because people get to the point where they say, well, I don't understand that, so it's worthless, or do you know what I mean? It isn't public. You aren't actually handing food to the homeless. So how can this glorify God?
Right. You know, I got into a little bit of trouble one time because I posted on a forum, a music forum one time, and they were talking about the validity of playing music, and how mm-hmm. they were saying how important it was in for humanity. And I made a comment that in the church, they were specifically talking about the church and how musicians are sometimes undervalued in the church, which I haven't found, but this particular forum was talking about this. And I said, you know, whether we're playing, using our music to help the congregation sing, or whether we're making a meal to bring to a shut-in, it's in the Lord's eyes, each person's offering is equally important. And someone chimed in and said, huh, Pamela thinks that making a meal equals, you know, something that is just as high and mighty as music. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that, again, in that Reformed tradition, we have an understanding that whatever we do, we're working for the glory of God. It's such a high calling. And whether we're an accountant, or we're we play piano, or we are cooking, you know, it one is not more spiritual in a sense than another.
Amen.
If that's your call. And what did you say before that about practicing and being fulfilled by it? I think because we're created to work too, with our hands, with our minds. For me, that it's both. It's so physical to play an instrument, but it's also very demanding mentally, and of course, then emotionally too, because you're having to bring a mood to a piece of music. So,
yeah, I was going to add that I think that especially with music, that there's a richness that is added to your Christian life, and which I think is why it's the Lord requires it in worship. And in Colossians 3, Paul says, let the word of Christ dwell in you richly as you teach and admonish one another with all wisdom, as you sing psalms, hymns, and spiritual songs with gratitude in your hearts to God. And so even, you know, this isn't sort of like a new idea of singing songs to the Lord, but it's proper, mm-hmm. you know. But I also wanted to ask you, I know that you, particularly Pamela, and I've only heard it from you, you've done a jazz rendition of a hymn, What Wondrous Love Is This? And mm-hmm. I was going to ask you, are there some other jazz hymns that you have done, and also what moved you to do a jazz rendition of a hymn?
Yeah, well, to answer your the first question, yes, I actually plan to make an entire recording of hymns that I've arranged, you know, for my in a jazz setting. So I've done about Well, I've done A Mighty Fortress and He Leadeth Me, Come Thou Fount. I've done those ones, and I'll use those in when they're collecting the offering, you know, or sometimes as a prelude.
I'm moving to Houston.
So, and I play the melody clearly, but I've reharmonized it with some more contemporary voicings that I wouldn't play with congregational singing, but that work really nicely with solo piano or with a trio. But I love to do that. And why did I do it with that? What Wondrous Love Is This? Well, I think as a jazz musicians, we are always looking for a good vehicle to use to improvise on. So if there's a melody that I like, if there's a, it could be a jazz standard, it could be a pop tune. It could be a hymn. It could be a children's song. I might find a way to make it work with what I do. And, it's really exciting. It's not that we're stuck just playing the Gershwin and the Cole Porter, songs from the 30s and 40s. Those are, our meat and potatoes. You know, if you can't play that music, you know, you can't get a gig if you're a jazz musician. It's just part of the repertoire. But it's exciting to see some other things come into to play. There's some musicians right now who are taking their traditions, be it from a Chinese tradition or from a Israeli folk tune tradition, and they're bringing that to jazz. Since jazz is so really global now, there's every country you go to, you could find someone who plays jazz music.
Or as they say in China, it's global.
So global. What they might it's really exciting to see all kinds of different songs being kind of fused with a jazz mindset or some jazz chords or certain rhythms to make them, just a little different. And I really have fun with it. I think it's really fun. And it's kind of a nice way to introduce some Christians to jazz who have not really heard a lot. And maybe they don't even know they like it, but then they hear, they might hear Amazing Grace, or they might hear, what was the other one I was thinking of? I can't remember. But anyway, Be Thou My Vision, that one.
Yeah. Oh, nice.
They might hear it with some different chords, and then hear an improv on it, and kind of be able to follow the form and go, oh, okay. It's being familiar with something. We often like what we're familiar with, and we don't like what's unfamiliar. So it's exciting in that way too.
Pamela, I had a what's in your iPod question. Everything from like a couple go-to albums that you like to play to like kind of pop guilty pleasures, if you have those. What are you listening to right now, either current or like I said, go-to albums that you always kind of fall back on in any genre, really.
Yeah. For classical music, I love the Rutter Requiem. I just think it's very beautiful. I was teaching at a college in California one time, and we performed it, and I played some of the organ and keyboard parts.
Nice.
But, you know, I've been going back and kind of revisiting some of the pop music that I used to listen to. Sometimes in addition to, a jazz concert or festival or something that I'm doing, I might play some private event where I'm more of a background in the background. So, I've learned, a lot of pop tunes over the years. And so I've revisited, like Elton John's Your Song. And, you know, I used to really be into, I still am into Sting and, the Eurythmics and a lot of a lot of music from the 1980s that I listen to. But there's a pianist who I just think is wonderful. His name is Mulgrew Miller, and he's from Memphis, and just a wonderful musician. He doesn't have that household name that everybody's familiar with, but he's an incredible piano player, and I really, really think he's doing wonderful things. And actually, he recorded a couple of hymns, Abide With Me and O Lord in the Morning Thou Shalt Hear. I can't remember the rest of it, but and that really inspired me because he's just, yeah, that was really neat to hear that. But those are I guess just a few that are on the top of my head.
Tupac. Tupac or Biggie.
Okay. Yeah,
that's on my iPod. I freely admit it. I got a playlist.
Yeah, I just got an MP3 player about 6 months ago. I'm really behind the times. I still like my CDs. I have to admit, I just, I just kind of come from that last few years of the generation that we bought LPs and we got them home, ripped off the plastic, and you could smell it, you could see it, you know, you could have the liner notes, and then you'd take it out. And so I mean, I still really like my CDs, but I'm getting more and more into listening to podcasts and the White Horse Inn, and there's a CD Baby podcast that's really informative for musicians, and it has all kinds of topics. So but getting back to the music, if it's good, I'm not too concerned about what it's what the music business labels it as, you know, if it's bluegrass or folk or jazz or country, if it's played well and the song speaks to me and the it's well recorded, it's, you know, I'll listen. So
nice.
So what are you up to these days? Are you writing anything or recording, or are you performing anywhere perhaps, or someone might be able to come and see?
Yeah, I'm performing a lot. The best place to check is my website, which is my name, PamelaYork.com. Mm-hmm. And there's you click on shows.
Yeah.
And it'll show you where I'm playing in Houston. At the end of July, I will be doing a few dates in Southern California. July 28th at Vitello's in LA, and the following night, the 29th, at an outdoor concert at Descanso Gardens. And I'll pretty much be in Houston for all of August, and then I've got a couple of dates in Seattle in September. And like I said, it's been a few years since my last recording, but I have a 16-month-old, and so usually it takes a while to recover from that first year of having a new baby. So I will be recording in the near future, and you can follow me on Facebook go to my website.
We'll put a bunch of links in the show notes so the listeners will be able to find you in different places. I had one more question for you, kind of theological. Do you think Keith Jarrett speaks in tongues when he's playing the piano? Anyone doesn't know, you'll hear him playing and he's always going,
he really sings
what he's playing. It's really incredible. Crazy. Sometimes annoying.
Yeah, it is. It kind of gets to the point where he's actually louder than the piano. So, and he's just one of those performers that, if he hears somebody unwrapping cough candy in the crowd, he'll stop and yell at them.
Yeah, he's not very tolerant, but he's a genius, and typically tolerance and genius don't go together.
Yeah,
right.
Well, this has been a pleasure. So thank you so much for joining us. I really appreciate you taking the time and putting up with us getting everything together. This has been excellent.
Well, it's been my pleasure too, and I just play keys for a living. So if I hopefully I could answer your spiritual questions.
I thought this was great.
It's very definitely informative. Something I'd like to think more about in the future, and really again, just learn a lot more about how to think and contemplate where theology and music and spiritual things meet. So
excellent. Yeah. Well, again, everyone can find Pamela at PamelaYork.com, and there you'll find links to her music, shows, and all sorts of other things. You can also find those links in our show notes. And you can visit Westminster online. A lot of what Jared and Jonathan are up to is available at youtube.com/Westminster Online and facebook.com/Westminster Online. And finally, of course, we're at reformedforum.org. And there you'll find information about all of our programs, as well as news and updates as to everything we are up to. So if you'd like to get a hold of us, why don't you email us at mail@reformedforum.org or Twitter us @reformedforum. Thank you so much for listening to the Reformed Media Review. But until next time, tola lege, pick up and read.